TV Guide Incorporated, the conglomerate that owns the magazine, boasts proudly that TV Guide Magazine and TV Guide Channel are the largest print and electronic guidance products in the world. The fact that the best-selling weekly magazine in the country is about television reflects the character of American culture. With 11 million subscribers and 34 million weekly readers, TV Guide is not just a guide to TV. TV Guide is also a guide to American culture and consciousness, or at least what passes for consciousness in those of us who pass for couch potatoes. It is, for better or worse, one important guide to our social and imaginative life. TV Guide provides weekly program listings for the shows of our lives, and it provides some guidance about program quality. But whatever else it does, TV Guide always guides us to TV. For this reason, it might be more aptly titled TV Guile. Roughly 98% of Americans watch some TV every day. On the basis of time invested, sleep is the primary lifetime activity of Americans. Work is second, but watching television is third. The average American watches about 7 nonstop years in a lifetime. Average daily household viewing time in 1999 is more than 7 hours. On the average, we watch TV more than we eat, more than any other leisure activity, and more than any religious or political activity. A Roper poll found that watching television is the most eagerly anticipated daily activity of 25% of Americans. Between the ages of 5 and 18, average American kids spend 14,000 hours in classes, quite an education. But they spend as many as 19,000 hours in front of the TV, where they see 10,000 acts of violence and 350,000 commercials. Television is our main educational system. By comparison, schools are basically extracurricular. And our attitude toward TV makes no statistical difference in our consumption of it. On average, people who dislike TV watch as much TV as those who like it. And people who complain about TV programming still turn on the TV, not so much to watch a particular show as to watch TV, whatever happens to be on. TV Guide guides us to TV, but TV itself guides us in a variety of ways. TV gives us television, which is significantly different than the normal vision of human beings through thousands of years of history. In the first place, the primary programming of TV, the ads, guides us to particular products that we need for the good life. Even more, TV ads guide us to the assumptions of American consumerism, that social and personal difficulties have commercial solutions, that we can buy product salvation with our purchases, and that if we buy the right things, life can be as easy as 1, 2, 3. And even the entertainment shows inform us. That is, they form us from within. Television provides an escape from reality for many of us. But television also profoundly affects our reality. In the movie Network, anchorman Howard Beale tells his audience that, "You people sit there night after night. You're beginning to believe this illusion we're spinning here. You're beginning to think that the tube is reality and your own lives are unreal. This is mass madness." And indeed it is, because many Americans do see TV as the real thing. Research by George Gerbner, former dean of the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Communications and the nation's premier TV critic, shows that heavy watchers of primetime TV receive what he calls a grossly distorted picture of the real world that they tend to accept more readily than they do reality itself. For example, on primetime TV, men outnumber women 3 to 1, and women are generally typecast as lovers or mothers, passive people dependent on their relationship to men. Only 20% of married women with children work in TV land versus 50% in the real world. And these skewed perceptions, says Gerbner, reinforce sexism. Heavy TV watchers tend to be more sexist than people who don't watch as much. The same patterns hold for depictions of old age, for treatments of black people, for depictions of work, which in TV land is largely managerial or professional. Crime is 10 times more common on TV than in everyday life. And 55% of primetime characters are involved in violence once a week. It's no surprise, then, that heavy watchers have unrealistic fears of victimization. Because television induces what Gerbner calls the mean world syndrome, what we think is simply light entertainment has some fairly heavy effects. Television is a way of seeing, but it's seldom really visionary. It can be a status symbol, but the status it gives us is always the status quo. It may offer 105 channels, but it channels our thinking, such as it is, into a single mainstream. But how is television related to our deeper visions of life? What would happen if, instead of watching TV, we got together to tell a vision to each other? What would our visions be like? What plots might we imagine if we weren't always embroiled in the plots of sitcoms and drama series, and in the plots of advertisers to sell us things we don't really need? From the American Studies Museum, this is Dr. America, guiding Americans through the cultural thicket of TV. The reason we Americans need historians is that historians recall what the rest of us generally forget. Our lives are run by dead people. We inhabit homes and institutions constructed by dead people. We govern ourselves by dead people's laws. We speak a lively language created mostly by dead people. We even live on land delineated in a way that dead people prescribed. The end of our Revolutionary War confronted the newly independent Americans with quite a range of problems and opportunities. Success in the war meant that the United States received practically all of the territory east of the Mississippi River. To secure its vast borders, this territory would need to be occupied. The army that defeated the British would now be turned against the Indians, who also stood in the way of progress. Winning the war also meant that the new nation would have to decide quickly how to open the new territories to settlement. And the United States of America would somehow need to raise its own revenues, in part to pay the soldiers who had fought the war. The solution was land, and more precisely, the Land Ordinance of 1785, which authorized surveying the Western Territories into 6-mile square townships, with their sides oriented due north-south and east-west. Each township would be divided into 36 sections of 640 acres each. The idea of townships 6 miles square came from the New England experience. The geometric grid came from Enlightenment thought, with its emphasis on order, control, and regularity, and from the urban grid of Philadelphia. This survey was made possible by the widespread adoption of Gunther's chain. This chain is a surveying tool made up of 100 links, each link 8 inches long. Each chain, therefore, is 22 yards long, and an acre is exactly 10 square chains. Landscape historian John Stilgo contends that no mathematical ratio is more important in the American Enlightenment landscape. That's because it synthesized traditional English measures and the new, more scientific decimal system, which Jefferson had also applied to the national currency. The grid was where geometry met geography, sometimes with disastrous results. It created the familiar checkerboard pattern that we now see from the air. But the rectilinear survey diverged from traditional natural practice, which took topography into account in citing farms and towns. And it also altered the look of the landscape, since roads were located on section lines, sometimes despite the topography, infuriating farmers who had to drive their teams through swamps or up and down hills. The grid is a form of human efficiency and economic improvement, which aren't necessarily ecological improvements. The grid was also problematic because it tried to superimpose a rectilinear grid on a round planet. Americans discovered, to their dismay, that there aren't a lot of straight lines in nature, especially on the surface of a sphere. By the time the first surveyors reached Ohio, they were so far off the east-west and north-south axes that they needed to tilt the grid by inserting some triangular sections. The grid system worked well for dividing and selling land as a commodity. It sped the process of converting land into property, and into private property at that. It put a big for sale sign on the earth, transferring the national domain into the private hands of settlers and land speculators. It started the process of settlement that has resulted in the suburban single-family home. Indeed, the survey grid became the new natural practice of the young nation, creating an invented natural order. This invented natural practice is even reflected in our language, where phrases like a square deal or a four-square man signify certain types of righteousness. But what if the Founding Fathers had decided to map and plat the land according to the logic of watersheds? What if they had paid more attention to the land and its quirks instead of abstracting it? What if their motives had been more ecological than economic? How would our lives be different? From the American Studies Museum, this is Dr. America, surveying the whole landscape of American culture and speculating not in land, but in ideas.